governments. No one could have received a better briefing on the arguments that would shape the political agenda of the Constitutional Convention. It was, to be sure, a briefing from the nationalist side of the argument. But Washington, who, as the presiding presence at the convention, would have to project otherworldly detachment, one of his best and favorite roles, was, in fact, a charter member of the nationalist camp. Soon after arriving in Philadelphia, he conveyed his personal convictions to Jefferson, who was watching from Paris. "Much is expected by some, but little by others, and nothing by a few. That something is necessary, all will agree. For the situation of the general government, if it can be called a government, is shaken to its foundation. In a word, it is at an end, and unless a remedy is soon applied, anarchy and confusion will inevitably ensue." Whether the situation in the spring of 1787 was as desperate as the situation in the spring of 1775 was a debatable question. They were, however, linked together in Washington's mind as two critical chapters in the same ongoing story called the American Revolution. His very presence in Philadelphia certified the connection between the two founding moments, the first to win independence, and the second to secure it. He was stepping forward again to play his accustomed and indispensable role. The first time, his life had been at stake. This time, it was his legacy. Votes and Voices. Washington was simultaneously the most important person at the Constitutional Convention and the least involved in the debate that shaped the document that emerged. His importance was a function of his presence, which lent an air of legitimacy to the proceedings that otherwise might have been criticized as extra-legal, if not a coup d'etat. The convention was legally empowered to revise the Articles of Confederation, not replace them. His silence during the debates was partially a function of his congenital reticence, but mostly the result of his role as president, whose job was to gavel the sessions to order, then listen as others spoke. The role suited him, for it allowed him to remain above the fray in the transcendent location that he preferred and that almost everyone accorded him. He entered the debate on only one occasion, the last day of the convention, when he endorsed a revision of the final draft that reduced the number of representatives constituting a congressional district from 40,000 to 30,000, a gesture probably designed to assure that he was on record as a participant as well as a signer. Otherwise, he enjoyed the best seat from which to hear the most consequential political debate in American history. What was he thinking? To the extent that his diary entries and correspondence during the summer of 1787 are guides, his mind was elsewhere. On the oppressive heat and humidity, on the renovations of his prize chariot, on the opportunity Philadelphia accorded to purchase rare items like a gold watch chain and two velvet jockey caps, and on Mount Vernon, where his nephew and new manager, George Augustine Washington, needed instruction about where to plant the pumpkins and peas, when to harvest the potatoes, and how to manage the mating of his reluctant jackass. On one occasion, June 4th, a witness described the crowds that gathered around him on Market Street when he was going to dinner. But Washington himself made no mention of his thoughts or feelings about experiencing public adulation after 4 years off the stage. Of course, his mind was not really as blank or distracted as the written record suggests, for the record reflects the vow of confidentiality all delegates were under to avoid any disclosure of the deliberations while the convention was in session. There were two breaks in the code of silence which provide clues to his state of mind on the substantive issues before the delegates. On July 10th, he wrote Hamilton, who had recently left the convention, pleading with him to return. Washington seemed to believe a crisis was at hand that required Hamilton's presence. "In a word," he confessed, "I almost despair of seeing a favorable issue to the proceedings of the convention, and do, therefore, repent having had any agency in the business." Ironically, this remark occurred just after what most scholars have come to regard as the major breakthrough of the convention, the Great Compromise, which resolved the impasse over representation by making it proportional to population in the lower house and by state in the Senate. Washington initially interpreted the compromise as a defeat instead of a great victory, because it diluted the principle of federal supremacy over the states. Then, on August 19th, when the delegates were engaged in a protracted debate about the powers of the executive and the mode of selecting him, Washington expressed his frustration with the timidity of some delegates and the somewhat diluted character of the document likely to result. "I am fully persuaded it is the best that can be obtained at the present moment," he told Knox, "under such diversity of ideas that prevail." A letter he wrote to Lafayette the day after the convention adjourned repeated the same equivocal endorsement. "It is now a child of fortune, to be fostered by some and buffeted by others. What will be the general opinion on or reception of it is not for me to decide, nor shall I say anything for or against it. If it be good, I suppose it will work its way good. If bad, it will recoil on the framers." Over the subsequent decades, and now centuries, the Constitution has been most admired for its artful ambiguities, in effect for refusing to resolve the question of state versus federal sovereignty, for sketching rather faintly the powers of the executive and judicial branches, for establishing a framework in which constitutional arrangements could evolve over the years rather than providing clear answers at that time. If this has proved to be the genius of the document, Washington thought it was its major weakness. He wanted the ambiguities clarified and the sketches filled out, at least sufficiently so to assure the creation of a national government empowered to force the states and citizenry into a budding American empire. Chairing the convention provided him with an extended education in political realities that exposed his preference for coercive clarity as an impossibility. For he witnessed a bewildering variety of regional interests and accents that could only be bundled together by compromises designed to leave the lines of authority blurred. In truth, there was as yet no such thing as an American nation that the Constitution could consolidate. No matter what Washington thought about America's providential future, it remained a latent prospect, still haunted by potent fears of centralized power, that even the most thoughtful observers, though not Washington himself, considered the core political legacy of the American Revolution. The debates in Philadelphia demonstrated then that a unified nation was still a work in progress. And in that sense, the ambiguous document that emerged accurately reflected both the limitations and the implications of that unsettled condition. On the return trip to Mount Vernon, there was a mishap at Head of Elk in which the bridge collapsed, seriously injuring Washington's horse. Luckily, or perhaps providentially, Washington had just dismounted before the accident, which led some observers to speculate that the old soldier was still Destiny's child, obviously being preserved for one last chapter of public service. At some unspoken level, Washington realized that his re-entry into public life at Philadelphia had forced a rewriting of the Cincinnatus script from which he could never turn back. Though he had purchased a 4-volume translation of Don Quixote before departing Philadelphia, Washington was temperamentally incapable of tilting at windmills or living by illusion, which meant that he knew full well that the ratification of the Constitution would carry him inexorably into the presidency. If he harbored any doubts on that score, his former aide disabused him in the inimitably assertive Hamiltonian style. "I take it for granted, sir, that you have concluded to comply with what will no doubt be the general call of your country in relation to the new government. You will permit me to say that it is indispensable you should lend yourself to the first operation. It is of little use to have introduced a system if the weightiest influence is not given to its firm establishment at the outset." If history and the American electorate were determined to hustle him down the path to power again, Washington was determined to take it one step at a time. The ratification of the Constitution, after all, was hardly a foregone conclusion. Indeed, the debates in the state conventions were likely to provide a more robust picture of the ideological disagreements than those at the Constitutional Convention, because the most outspoken enemies of reform had stayed away from Philadelphia. Washington had vowed to play no public role in the ratification process, but he had not promised to remain a disinterested observer. As he told Hamilton, "I have read every performance which has been printed on one side and the other of the great question lately agitated." He was most impressed with the series of essays by Publius, later entitled The Federalist Papers, which he correctly predicted would outlive the current crisis to become a classic. "When the transient circumstances and fugitive performances which attend the crisis shall have disappeared," he apprised Hamilton, "that work will merit the notice of posterity." He was fully aware that Hamilton, Madison, and Jay were the authors of the Publius series, for they also formed the entourage of talented advisers that again surrounded him, making Mount Vernon into the electoral headquarters for plotting strategy and tracking the state-by-state results as they rolled in throughout the spring of 1788. Washington's ongoing assessment of the ratification process benefited from the peerless advice of Madison, who was proving himself the shrewdest political thinker in Virginia, perhaps in the nation. It also drew upon his own experience at winning a contest that, on the face of it, looked dubious at best. Like the War of Independence, he explained, the ratification struggle mobilized latent talents, he mentioned Publius, that would otherwise have remained dormant. And such desperate occasions as Shays's Rebellion, much like the winter encampment at Valley Forge, actually created the conditions for ultimate victory. He expressed confidence that, despite formidable opposition in such key states as Virginia and New York, ratification enjoyed certain strategic advantages. Because only 9 states were necessary for ratification, and because the most problematic debates in Virginia and New York occurred late in the convention cycle, enormous pressure to join the winning coalition would be exerted on opponents there. Washington paid particular attention to the debates in Virginia, where 2 old friends and former colleagues, Patrick Henry and George Mason, were leading the opposition. In an oblique reference to the burden of slavery being carried by Virginia's planter class, he noted that it was a little strange that the men of large property in the South should be more afraid that the Constitution should produce an aristocracy or monarchy than the genuine democratical people of the East. He also expressed the opinion that Virginia's most prominent Tidewater planters, many on the verge of bankruptcy, retained an unrealistic and inflated sense of their current prowess. "I am sorry to add in this place that Virginians entertain too high an opinion of the importance of their own country." Instead of regarding itself as primus inter pares among the states, Virginia should recognize that, in point of strength, it is comparatively weak, and in fact had more to gain than lose by joining the Union. When ratification became official in the late summer of 1788, even though he had been plotting and cheerleading from the sidelines for nearly a year, Washington was still dancing his private minuet about what ratification meant for him. His correspondence is littered with tortured declarations of uncertainty and platitudinous statements about entering a veil of tears or a field enveloped on every side with clouds and darkness. By this time, however, he was dancing only with himself, since ratification had closed off any escape. Upon hearing that his former chief continued to mutter threats about rejecting the presidency, Hamilton sent a bracing rebuke, reminding Washington that by chairing the Constitutional Convention, he had pledged to take a part in the execution of the government. All his personal anguishing implied that he had some choice in the matter, which was a delusion. Washington thanked Hamilton for the forthright message with its manly tone and stopped leaking threats about barricading himself at Mount Vernon. But he never completely ended his litany of lamentations, telling Knox on the very eve of his inauguration that "my movement to the chair of government will be accompanied by feelings not unlike those of a culprit who is going to the place of his execution." Though he unquestionably meant what he said, his thinking was multi-layered. Like his earlier expressions of reticence about becoming commander-in-chief of the Continental Army, modern sensibilities make it difficult to comprehend Washington's psychological chemistry on this score and dispose us to interpret his routinized reticence as either a disingenuous ploy or a massive case of denial. But in Washington's world, no prominent statesman regarded the forthright expression of political ambition as legitimate, and anyone who actively campaigned for national office was thereby confessing he was unworthy of election. What makes then so different from now was the aristocratic assumption that any explicit projection of self-interest in the political arena betrayed a lack of control over one's own passions, which did not bode well for the public interest. Washington carried this ethos to an extreme, insisting that any mention of his willingness to serve as president prior to the election violated the code. Of course, he knew that he was a candidate. He also knew that Madison was counting the electoral votes for president as the different states tallied up the results in January 1789. But when a correspondent mentioned his foreordained presidency, he expressed outrage that the subject was raised or even obliquely forced upon my mind. This was both a sincere statement and a scripted role. Indeed, at the time he wrote it, Washington was outlining his domestic and foreign policy priorities as president to Lafayette and consulting with David Humphreys about the contents of a 73-page draft of his inaugural address. In effect, by denying his interest in the office, He demonstrated that he was in control of his ambitions. By privately preparing to serve, he began to assume control of his forthcoming responsibilities. Part of him did feel old and longed to live out whatever years remained beneath his vines and fig trees. Another part realized that Hamilton was right, and that part was beginning to gird up for the next appointment with destiny. The public posture melded the two feelings. He did not seek this assignment, indeed had hoped to avoid it. But when called, he would be ready once again to serve. As in 1775, when he was made commander-in-chief, the vote was unanimous. All 69 electors voted for Washington, and enough of them, 34, also voted for John Adams to make him vice president. On April 7th, the Confederation Congress dispatched its secretary, Charles Thompson, to Mount Vernon in order to apprise Washington officially of the results. Just as Washington had sustained the fiction that he was unaware of his candidacy, Congress sustained the fiction that, until informed, Washington did not know he had won. Humphreys had already drafted an acceptance speech containing the customary platitudes about being called to an arduous task for which he was woefully unprepared. On April 14th, surrounded by a small entourage of secretaries and servants, Washington at last ended his evasive dance, declaring officially to Thompson that the unanimous vote scarcely leaves me the alternative for an option. The first presidential election had in fact been a plebiscite on who most embodied the values of the American Revolution. Although the debates in the Constitutional Convention, and then in the state ratifying conventions, had demonstrated that these values were bitterly contested, the unanimous vote for Washington demonstrated that one man provided a symbolic solution acceptable to all sides. There had been no campaign platform providing voters with his position on the contested issues, because there had been no campaign. He was not chosen for what he thought, but for who he was. In the political vocabulary of the day, there was no word fit to describe his unique status. But the word that came closest was stigmatized by the very values he had been chosen to embody. "You are now a king under a different name," wrote one thrilled supporter, James McHenry from Maryland, "and I am well satisfied that sovereign prerogatives have in no age or country been more honorably obtained, or that at any time they will be more prudently and wisely exercised." This was dangerous talk, and Washington knew it. The ill-defined powers of the American presidency left considerable room for honest disagreement. But one point on which all sides could agree was that it was not an electoral version of monarchy, and George Washington was not the second coming of George III. Writing from Paris, Gouverneur Morris reported the delectable piece of gossip that George III's mounting insanity had produced a delusional fit in which he imagined himself to be the second coming of Washington. In the lengthy first draft of his inaugural address, blessedly never delivered, Washington had seen fit to insert a defensive comment, observing that he had no direct heirs or immediate offspring, and therefore no family to build in greatness upon my country's ruin. There could be no Washington monarchy because there could be no Washington dynasty. His decision to order several yards of superfine broadcloth from a Hartford manufacturer for his inaugural suit also suggested that he wanted to make a sartorial statement of Republican simplicity that countered the royal image. But no matter what he said or what he wore at his inauguration. Eventually he discarded the broadcloth outfit for a suit of black velvet. Washington was revered by the bulk of the American citizenry as a quasi-king whose special status had been earned rather than inherited. The public reverence accorded to royalty was put on display during Washington's week-long trip from Mount Vernon to New York, which became one prolonged coronation ceremony. It began with crowds of more than 10,000 celebrants cheering him amidst cannon salutes and poetic tributes at Baltimore and Wilmington. Outside Philadelphia, he was obliged to mount a white horse so that the 20,000 spectators could see him as he crossed the Schuylkill. Charles Wilson Peale had designed an arch of triumph over the bridge, and his daughter Angelica lowered a laurel crown upon Washington's head as he passed under the arch. At Trenton, a chorus of white-robed girls tossed flowers from their baskets in his path while singing a tribute to "The Defender of the Mothers, the Protector of the Daughters." A congressional committee greeted him at Elizabethtown, where a 50-foot barge manned by 13 white-smocked sailors rowed him across the Hudson. A flotilla of decorated ships and sloops pulled alongside the barge as he approached New York Harbor, and a chorus aboard one of the sloops sang an ode composed for the occasion to the tune of "God Save the King." "Thrice welcome to this shore, our leader now no more, but ruler thou. O truly good and great, long live to glad our state, where countless honors wait to deck thy brow." And so the retirement, which had begun in the expectation of solitude and the presumption of finality, now ended with a plebiscite of unprecedented approval and the adoring voices of ordinary American citizens ringing in his ears. What was he thinking at this dramatic moment of transition back into the public arena? Reading Washington's famously and often purposely enigmatic mind is always a tricky business, never more so than on emotionally complicated occasions like his acceptance of the presidency. When he delivered his brief and willfully innocuous inaugural address in the Senate chamber of Federal Hall on April 30th, one witness found his performance appropriately solemn and sure-handed. Another thought the speech uninspired and Washington's demeanor awkward, as if he wished to be somewhere else, and more nervous before the audience than he had ever been when facing British cannon and muskets. The inaugural address itself was deliberately elliptical, offering little indication of his political agenda for the new government. His fullest statement on that score had been made in a private letter to Lafayette the previous summer. It seemed to suggest that his twin priorities were the restoration of fiscal responsibility and the creation of political credibility for the nascent national government. "When the people shall find themselves secure under an energetic government, when foreign nations shall be disposed to give us equal advantages in commerce from dread of retaliation, when the burdens of the war shall be in a manner done away by the sale of Western lands, when the seeds of happiness which are sown here shall begin to expand themselves, and when every one under his own vine and fig tree shall begin to taste the fruits of freedom, then all these blessings, for all these blessings will come, will be referred to the fostering influence of the new government. Indeed, I do not believe that Providence has done so much for nothing." In effect, He hoped to lend his prestige to the fledgling federal government, thereby helping it survive its most formative and fragile phase, providing the necessary credibility until this nation in the making began to feel comfortable behaving as a single people instead of a confederation of states. The contradictory reactions to his inaugural address probably reflected his own conflicting emotions. His reservations were real, we know, because the Cincinnatus pose had always been more than a pose. Physically, we know, he felt past his prime, no longer oblivious to the fatigue and demanding regimen that accompanied life at center stage in the public arena. Also, on the negative side, his most intimate confidant, Martha, was not with him. She had elected to stay behind at Mount Vernon until the celebratory fireworks died down and accommodations in New York had been arranged. His personal servant, Billy Lee, who had accompanied him on all his previous campaigns, was also missing. He had tried to make the trip, but two crippling knee injuries had forced him to drop out of the procession in Philadelphia. Someone else would have to comb and tie Washington's hair and anticipate his daily needs. But alongside his personal doubts about risking his hard-won reputation, alongside reservations about his advancing age and the absence of his accustomed support system, there were those crowds of cheering well-wishers stretching from Virginia to New York, expressing their bottomless confidence that he was the indispensable man. If he were truly superhuman, as many of his admirers believed, he would have felt no surge of fresh energy listening to their cheers. But, of course, he was not. The protracted coronation procession served as the palpable companion of the unanimous electoral vote, and probably combined to buoy him above his personal doubts. His silence and code of control preclude certainty here, propelling him forward toward the presidency. If this were not enough, the applause reinforced his lifelong experience of winning every wager against the odds, whether it was at the Monongahela, Princeton, or Yorktown. It seems likely that his remarks to Lafayette about American national destiny, namely that it was foreordained, also described his sense of his own fate. In any event, his inauguration now joined at the hip the two destinies, which boded well for both. If the doubts were real, the providential forces were more potent. When the mix of moods coalesced, then he most probably entered the presidency with a bittersweet sense that he had done everything humanly possible to avoid this outcome, but that he was, once again, the chosen instrument of history. Chapter 6. First in Peace. Looking back over 200 years of the American presidency, it seems safe to say that no one entered the office with more personal prestige than Washington. And only two presidents, Abraham Lincoln and Franklin Roosevelt, faced comparable crises. The Civil War and the Great Depression, though distant in time, remain more recent and raw in our collective memory than the American founding. So we find it easier to appreciate the impressive achievements of Lincoln and Roosevelt in negotiating the nation through these latter-day challenges. Washington's achievement must be recovered before it can be appreciated, which means that we must recognize that there was no such thing as a viable American nation when he took office as president, that the opening words of the Constitution, We, the people of the United States, expressed a fervent but fragile hope rather than a social reality. The roughly 4 million settlers spread along the coastline and streaming over the Alleghenies felt their primary allegiance, to the extent they felt any allegiance at all, to local, state, and regional authorities. No Republican government had ever before exercised control over a population this diffuse or a landmass this large. And the prevailing assumption among the most informed European observers was that, to paraphrase Lincoln's later formulation, a nation so conceived and so dedicated could not endure. Washington's core achievement as president, much as it had been as commander-in-chief of the Continental Army, was to transform the improbable into the inevitable. The point was put nicely by a French nobleman visiting Mount Vernon in 1791 before setting out on a quest for the elusive, in fact non-existent, water route across the North American continent. "But it is less difficult to discover the Northwest Passage," he explained, "than to create a people, as you have done." Assessments of Washington's presidency tend to be forward-looking, understandably concerned with the constitutional precedents he set for the executive branch in such specific areas as the cabinet system, control over foreign policy, the veto, executive appointments, and setting the legislative agenda. But once again, any comprehensive appraisal of Washington's legacy must also be backward-looking, which means recovering the highly problematical attitude toward executive power that pervaded the political culture when he assumed office. When he observed that, "I walk on untrodden ground," Washington obviously meant that as the first American president, everything he did set a precedent. Less obviously, his privileged perch at the Constitutional Convention allowed him to recognize that the ground surrounding the American presidency was not just untrodden. The air around it was filled with menacing memories of George III. There was an unspoken reason why the final draft of the Constitution devoted more space to the rules for electing or removing the president than to delineating the powers of the office itself. Much like the reluctance to mention slavery explicitly, the reticence about the scope of presidential authority reflected a widespread apprehension that any direct discussion of the subject subverted the core principles of republicanism itself. If slavery was the proverbial ghost at the banquet at the Constitutional Convention, monarchy was its spectral accomplice. When Patrick Henry claimed that the Constitution squints toward monarchy, he spoke for a potent collection of skeptics who regarded any projection of executive power as a betrayal of the spirit of 76. Although Washington did not share Henry's conspiratorial suspicions, he did understand that accepting the presidency meant living the central paradox of the early American Republic. That is, what was politically essential for a viable American nation was ideologically at odds with what it claimed to stand for. The specter of monarchy haunted Washington's entire presidency, especially during his second term, when the monarchical murmurs became full-fledged attacks on both his policies and character. They wounded him more deeply than any criticism he received as commander-in-chief during the war. The personal criticism also stunned him because he was both intellectually and emotionally ill-equipped to comprehend the shrill partisanship that came to define the political culture of the 1790s, and that shredded any and all efforts to stand above the fray. He found himself in the ironic position of being the indispensable man in a political world that regarded all leaders as disposable. Without him to center it, the political experiment in republicanism might very well have failed. With him, and in great part because of him, it succeeded. But in doing so, it rendered the non-partisan values he embodied anachronistic. Another specter that hovered over the Washington presidency was age. From the time that Governor Dinwiddie had dispatched him into the western wilderness as a youthful emissary, Washington's physical prowess had been his most elemental asset. At the Monongahela, then in the battles at Trenton, Princeton, and Yorktown during the War of Independence, bullets and shrapnel seemed to veer away from his body as if he were surrounded by an electromagnetic field of invulnerability. Like a natural athlete who takes his superb body for granted, Washington was accustomed to commanding any room or scene visually and physically. As we have seen, chinks in his armor began to appear in the 1780s, when the inevitable ravages of age started to soften him. And these symptoms of physical deterioration gave palpable shape to his increasingly fatalistic recognition that Washington men were genetically programmed to wear out early and die relatively young. Two events early in his presidency reinforced these intimations of mortality. In June 1789, a large tumor appeared on his left thigh, which eventually required surgery to remove. For a few days, his condition was critical, and the street in front of the presidential mansion was roped off to prevent passing carriages from disturbing his recovery. Then, in May 1790, he collapsed with influenza and lingered near death for 3 days with pulmonary complications. During his lengthy recuperation, visitors reported that his eyes were permanently teary, his hearing was almost completely blocked, and his famously robust constitution seemed to have aged overnight. Washington himself acknowledged that recovery from the two illnesses had drained all his recuperative resources, so that another serious sickness, as he put it, would put me to sleep with my fathers. Jefferson's gloss on Washington's physical decline, as we shall see, is not to be fully trusted, but he suggested the assaults on the president's body also had mental consequences. The firm tone of his mind, for which he had been remarkable, was beginning to relax. A listlessness of labor, a desire for tranquility had crept on him, and a willingness to let others act or even think for him. Washington was not creeping toward senility, as Jefferson implied, nor was he too dazed to manage the duties of his presidency, as Jefferson claimed. But he was no longer the same vigorous man who had spent nearly 8 years in the field leading the Continental Army. Throughout his presidency, he felt the sand in his personal hourglass running out, the relentless burdens of the office squeezing out the last remaining months, weeks, days, and hours of private serenity allotted him. Martha spoke for both of them when, soon after joining him in New York in May 1789, she exclaimed that she felt more like a prisoner than anything else. Washington's constant refrain about retiring to bucolic splendor beneath his vines and fig trees was, true enough, a formulaic refrain within the leadership class of the revolutionary generation, especially the Virginia dynasty. And his previous declarations of reticence, when called to command the Continental Army or chair the Constitutional Convention, were classical lines in a Ciceronian motif designed to conceal his ambitions from the world and even perhaps from himself. But now the role of Cincinnatus had become his truly preferred destination. No president in American history wished to avoid the office more than Washington. All of which helps explain one of the chief curiosities of his presidential correspondence. The longest letters, and more of them than he devoted to any official topic, deal with the management of his farms at Mount Vernon. Even when immersed in crucial diplomatic negotiations with France, or controversial deliberations about Hamilton's fiscal policy, Washington found time to compose meticulous instructions to his managers about plowing, weeding, worming, or grubbing schedules, about when to stock the ice house, about the personalities and work habits of different overseers or slave laborers, about proper food and rum rations at harvest time. One can read these letters as a continuance of his obsessive urge to remain the strenuous squire, the honest inclinations of a man who felt more genuine excitement discussing the merits of a new threshing machine than the intricacies of the Jay Treaty. Or one could, more speculatively, argue that the Mount Vernon correspondence allowed him to retain a zone of personal control amidst an increasingly discordant political world that seemed to defy control altogether. But in the end, the most compelling explanation is that Washington's soul, or at least the last sliver of his private personality, never made the trip to New York and then Philadelphia, but remained ensconced at Mount Vernon. One of the shrewdest of Washington's biographers has suggested his private self had been effectively obliterated by the time he reached the presidency, that the man, if you will, had become the monument. While this was probably true for the way most of Washington's contemporaries viewed him, it was not the way Washington viewed himself. And this personal perspective must stand as the final context for understanding his presidency. If the constitutional context looks forward to the landmark precedents for the executive branch, and if the historical context looks backward to the specter of monarchy haunting all energetic projections of executive power, the personal context looks southward, toward Mount Vernon, the only place where he could shed his public role and be himself. Presiding Presidency. Not much happened at the executive level during the first year of Washington's presidency, which was exactly the way he wanted it. His official correspondence was dominated by job applications from veterans of the war, former friends, and total strangers, most of whom pleaded for patronage in the highly deferential style that Washington himself had employed toward his British betters during the French and Indian War. They all received the same Republican response: merit, rather than favoritism, must determine all federal appointments. As for the president himself, it was not clear whether he was taking the helm or merely occupying the bridge. Rumors began to circulate that he regarded his role as primarily ceremonial and symbolic, that after 2 years he intended to step down, having launched the American ship of state and contributed his personal prestige as ballast on its maiden voyage. There was talk of a brief and wholly presiding presidency. As it turned out, even ceremonial occasions raised troubling questions because no one knew how the symbolic centerpiece of a republic should behave or even what to call him. Vice President Adams, trying to be helpful, ignited a fiery debate in the Senate by suggesting such regal titles as His Elective Majesty or His Mightiness, which provoked a lethal combination of shock and laughter, as well as the observation that Adams himself should be called His Rotundity. Eventually, the Senate resolved on the most innocuous option available. The President of the United States should be called exactly that, no more and no less. Matters of social etiquette. How should the President interact with the public? Where should he be accessible and where insulated? Prompted multiple memoranda on the importance of what Hamilton called a pretty high tone that stopped short of secluding the President like an Eastern Lama. The solution was a weekly open house called the Levee, part imperial court ceremony replete with choreographed bows and curtsies, part drop-in parlor social. The levees struck the proper middle note between courtly formality and Republican simplicity, though at the expense of becoming notoriously boring and wholly scripted occasions only periodically enlivened by impromptu acts of spontaneity, as when Washington once bent over to kiss the widow of Nathaniel Greene on the cheek. The very awkwardness of the levees fit Washington's temperament nicely, since he possessed a nearly preternatural ability to remain silent while everyone around him was squirming under the social pressure to fill the silence with chatty conversation. Adams later claimed that this gift of silence was Washington's greatest political asset, which Adams himself so envied because he lacked the gift altogether. Washington also possessed distancing mechanisms that deflected intrusions into the space around his body, much as they had deflected bullets on the battlefield. The formal etiquette of the levees, combined with Washington's natural dignity, or was it aloofness, to create a political atmosphere unimaginable in any modern-day national capital. Namely, in a year when the French Revolution broke out in violent spasms destined to reshape the entire political landscape of Europe, and the Congress, under Madison's deft guidance, ratified a Bill of Rights that codified the most sweeping guarantee of individual rights ever enacted, no one at the levees discussed these major events or expected Washington to comment on them. Washington's urge to keep himself and his presidency hovering above the political fray received assistance from the only other unequivocal occupant of America's pantheon. In April 1790, his sole rival as the premier American hero, Benjamin Franklin, finally went to his maker. In his will, Franklin bequeathed his Crabtree walking stick to Washington, explaining that, "If it were a scepter, he has merited it and would become it." The notion of a Crabtree scepter had the perfect Franklin touch, a seamless blend of the ordinary and the elevated. A month earlier, the first medal minted in the United States bearing Washington's image on one side and his accomplishments on the other appeared in Philadelphia. And a month before then, in February 1790, the practice of celebrating Washington's birthday as a national holiday became a tradition. It all contributed to the impression that Washington was not directing the government so much as floating above the infant republic as a sagacious and beloved guardian. Even the matters of etiquette and symbolism, however, could have constitutional consequences, as Washington learned in August 1789. The treaty-making power of the President required that he seek the advice and consent of the Senate. He initially interpreted the phrase to require his personal appearance in the Senate and the solicitation of senatorial opinion on specific treaty provisions in the mode of a large advisory council. But when he brought his proposals for treaties with several southern Indian tribes to the Senate, the debate became a prolonged shouting match over questions of procedure. The longer the debate went on, the more irritated Washington became, eventually declaring, "This defeats every purpose of my coming here." He abruptly stalked out of the session, as one witness reported, with a discontented air of sullen dignity. From that time onward, the phrase "advise and consent" meant something less than direct executive solicitation of senatorial opinion, and the role of the Senate as an equal partner in the crafting of treaties came to be regarded as a violation of the separation of powers principle. Though he never revisited the Senate, he did honor his pledge to visit all the states in the Union. In the fall of 1789, he launched a month-long tour of New England that carried him through 60 towns and hamlets. Everywhere he went, the residents turned out in droves to glimpse America's greatest hero parading past. And everywhere he went, New Englanders became Americans, at least for the duration of his visit. The only sour note was a patch of bad weather at the end, which produced an epidemic of respiratory infections among the throngs of well-wishers who had waited for hours in the cold rain to see him in the flesh. In an ironic tribute, newspapers named the epidemic after him. Since Rhode Island had not yet ratified the Constitution, he skipped it, then made a separate trip the following summer to welcome the proudly independent latecomer into the new nation. During a visit to the Jewish synagogue in Newport, he published an address on religious freedom that turned out to be the most uncompromising endorsement of the principle he ever made. One must say made rather than wrote, because there is considerable evidence that Jefferson wrote it. Whatever sectional suspicions New Englanders might harbor toward that faraway thing called the federal government, when it appeared in their local neighborhoods in the majestic form of George Washington, they saluted, cheered, toasted, and embraced it as their own. The Southern tour was a more grueling affair, covering nearly 2,000 miles during the spring of 1791. Instead of regarding it as a threat to his health, however, Washington described it as a tonic. The real risk, he believed, was the sedentary life of a desk-bound president. The entourage of 11 horses included his white parade steed, Prescott, whom he mounted at the edge of each town in order to make an entrance that accorded with the heroic mythology surrounding his military career. Prescott's hooves were painted and polished before each appearance, and Washington usually brought along his favorite greyhound, mischievously named Cornwallis, to add to the dramatic effect. Much like a modern political candidate on the campaign trail, Washington's speeches at each stop repeated the same platitudinous themes, linking the glory of the War of Independence with the latent glory of the newly established United States. The linkage came naturally at places like Charleston, Camden, and Guilford Courthouse, former battlefields in the Southern campaign that Washington was seeing for the first time. The ladies of Charleston fluttered alongside their fans when Washington took the dance floor. Prescott and the four carriage horses held up despite the nearly impassable and often non-existent roads. Cornwallis, however, wore out and was buried on the banks of the Savannah River in a brick vault with a marble tombstone that local residents maintained for decades as a memorial to his master's historic visit. In the end, all the states south of the Potomac could say they had seen the palpable version of the flag, which was Washington himself. During the Southern tour, one of the earliest editorial critiques of Washington's rather conspicuous embodiment of authority appeared in the press. He was being treated at each stop like a canonized American saint, the editorial lamented, or perhaps like a demigod perfumed by the incense of addresses. But the chief complaint harked back to the primordial fear haunting all republics. However highly we may consider the character of the chief magistrate of the Union, yet we cannot but think the fashionable mode of expressing our attachment favors too much of monarchy to be used by Republicans, or to be received with pleasure by the president of a commonwealth. Such criticisms were rarely uttered publicly during the initial years of Washington's presidency. But they lurked in the background, exposing how double-edged the political imperatives of the American Revolution had become. To secure the revolutionary legacy on the national level required a singular character who embodied national authority more visibly than any collective body like Congress could convey. Washington had committed himself to playing that role by accepting the presidency. Indeed, he regarded his symbolic role as the core function of his presidency. But at the center of the revolutionary legacy lay a virulent suspicion of any potent projection of political power by a singular figure. And since the very idea of a Republican chief executive was a novelty, there was no available vocabulary to characterize such a creature except the verbal traditions surrounding European courts and kings. By playing the role that he believed history required, Washington made himself vulnerable to the most potent set of apprehensions about monarchical power that recent American history could muster. He could justifiably claim to be the one and only singular character who could credibly insist